Our pets are really part of the family for many of us, and while the word pet mostly brings up a mental image of a dog or a cat, there are many other types of animals that are fascinating and fun to have around. And folks that have an exotic pet will tell you that they are just as attached to their pet as you might be to your canine or feline friends. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Dr. Kurt Slatke is a clinical associate professor in zoological medicine and section head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. He has an incredible range of experience and depth of knowledge in the care of all kinds of exotic pets, and we're really happy to have him spend time with us today. Dr. Slatke, great to have you back.
Hi, Judith. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm really happy to be back.
It's always a lot of fun, and I think it's really fascinating to find out about the wide variety of creatures that can be great pets. And so when we talk about exotics, what type of pets are we talking about?
I think generally, although some people would consider rabbits and rats to be domesticated, I would say that anything from invertebrates, including tarantulas and Madagascar hissing cockroaches, through fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and then in general, small mammals. People keep rats, chinchillas, guinea pigs, rabbits, primates as well.
Hedgehogs. I've always had a desire for a hedgehog.
Yeah. Some hedgehogs, the more you spend time, I mean, most people think, oh, it's a nocturnal insectivore. That's an odd thing to have as a pet. But people who spend a lot of time with their hedgehogs, the hedgehogs can be quite interactive. So not just ball up when they come to the vet office and not want to
which
be
is
touched,
how you usually see
which
them.
Which is how I always see them.
Another hedgehog ball coming through the door. So that whole range, and as we were talking about before the show, and as I just mentioned, you know, people who are used to cats and dogs might think, you know, how can you get attached to a snake or a hissing cockroach? but you know, there are all kinds of ways that those pets are really rewarding.
I have met every type of individual, and that would I have people who are just obsessed with arachnids. So they may own 20 or 30 tarantulas, and they're very interactive. I mean, the animal, once it gets used to you, likes to spend time with you. And I have people who are just fanatics for rats, and rats have a very short life. So it's kind of a bittersweet pet to have, but they're incredibly smart. They live about approximately 3 years, but they are also, I have a lot of kids who just come in with their rat in their front pocket, and people just have become very bonded to that particular individual pet. Just like a dog or cat, a person can become as bonded to a rat or a boa constrictor, whatever species.
And with warm weather coming, eventually at least, we often think of things like don't leave your dog in a car with the windows up and things like that. But what should we keep in mind for keeping our exotic pets safe from, say, heat-related problems?
I think, you know, if I break down into different groups, if you're thinking some of the small mammals have real problems with heat stroke and overheating, and that would be especially small mammals like guinea pigs and chinchillas and rabbits. And it's very important that in hot weather that you keep them in a place that if it's too hot outside, move them inside into an air-conditioned space. If you have to keep the animal outside in the summer, simple things like buying filling a liter pop bottle with water and freezing it and providing a cool ice source next to so the rabbit can lie next to it. That's what we used to do in the zoo world when I was at North Carolina, where it's very hot in the summer. We provide iced liter bottles for the rabbits to lie next to in the children's zoo. Other species, like many people want to get their reptiles outside in the summer, get some sun, which can be a great idea. But if you have a small lizard in an aquarium and you put them outside, they can actually bake. Mm-hmm. So because it gets very, there's no air movement, it gets very hot. So those are the things. I think the main thing. Certainly, don't leave your bird or small mammal or reptile in a closed car either. It's the same sort of principle. And most mammals, and including mammals and birds as well will pant to try to get rid of heat. Many of them will pant, so much like a dog. So it's really important to at least keep those things in mind. Provide shelter outside for your turtles and tortoises if they're outside, and provide a cool spot for your small mammals.
And with birds, do birds enjoy being outdoors, or is it good for them to say if you move their cage out when you're sitting out on the patio or something, or is that change of environment a little too much for them?
I think as long as the bird is well contained, birds enjoy the sun. You can spritz them with water and they groom themselves. There's no question, we don't fully understand the how in some species we don't fully understand how beneficial vitamin D is, but obviously all of these animals have evolved outside, and so I think getting sun for some animals is really important.
And one of the things that we were talking about yesterday with entomologist Phil Pelletieri is as warm weather comes, so do bug populations, and a lot of owners of exotic pets like reptiles might be thinking, oh, great, I can just go out and gather some insects for my pet instead of buying them. Are there pluses or minuses to doing that?
That's a really interesting question. Many people go out. I mean, there is something to say to be said about environmental enrichment, providing a variety of insects to those species which tend to eat insects. Species like bearded dragons, which are very popular. We have a number of clients who will go out and collect moths or small other small invertebrates and feed their bearded dragons, but there's an interesting phenomenon in bearded dragons especially that there's a toxicity issue, and we don't fully understand what insects are toxic to all species. But we do know fireflies are highly toxic to some of the insectivorous reptiles, and we've treated a few of these cases where it not only toxic but causes death in many bearded dragons if fireflies are fed to bearded dragons. So you have to be very selective and cautious. The one thing about, especially about wild-caught insects, is many of them are vectors for disease. So cockroaches, for example, if you feed cockroaches, they might carry viruses or parasites that can be harmful to the animal that in your care. And also, you have to think about in the summer and spring, mosquitoes, which are vectors for diseases like West Nile virus. We do see West Nile virus in birds. We see West Nile virus in reptiles as well.
And that would be dangerous not only to them, but also to the human beings that are around them.
Exactly. And that would be, you know, not necessarily feeding mosquitoes. Mosquitoes need to spread those diseases through an actual bite. And mosquitoes can bite through thick reptile skin even and cause disease. So,
And also I was thinking about insects that might be in the garden. They might have crawled or flown through not even something like pesticides or herbicides, but maybe even fertilizer that could, I would think, could be dangerous to a pet as well.
Another excellent point. If you allow your animals to go outside, whether it's a tortoise that's right in the grass, right in the foliage of your yard, it is really important to place them in places where pesticides and herbicides have not been sprayed. And if you take your bird outside on your back porch, but you've had an herbicide put on your lawn recently, that herbicide is aerosolized. And birds are highly sensitive to anything that's in the air.
There's a reason why it's a canary in a coal mine, right?
Exactly.
Too bad for the canaries, but.
And you're right about invertebrates being, you know, crawling through a variety of environments or flying through a variety of environments and potentially having other material on their body, on their exoskeleton.
We're talking with Dr. Kurt Slatke, who specializes in the care of exotic species at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today, and we'd love to have you join the conversation when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, a comment, or a photo of your exotic pet on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And So, Dr. Sladke, I think most of us know that our dogs and cats need regular checkups with a vet, just like we all need to see a doctor once in a while to make sure everything is as it should be, or take care of it if it's not. What about our exotic pets? Is it the same kind of schedule of care?
I think this is bias, but I think it's even more important and more critical that you bring your exotic pet to the veterinarian on a regular basis, because they tend to hide their disease very well. And birds are the classic example. They hide their disease and they compensate until they, what I would call, hit the wall and decompensate. And what looks like an immediate problem has actually been going on for months. And if we are able to do routine physical exams, especially with blood work on exotic pets, it helps us identify potential problems, and maybe if the animal can be treated ahead of time before it turns into a sort of a crisis with a decompensating animal, we feel that that's basically why I feel that having regular checkups on exotic pets is really important.
And it seems also that, for the most part, exotic pets' behavior is not as familiar to us as I think most people could see a change in the behavior of their cat or their dog. And it's fairly obvious if they're not feeling well, all of a sudden they're not eating, or, you know, they're really lethargic. But it might be a little harder to tell if it's a tarantula or even a reptile. I mean, I'm sure there are subtle differences, but I'm guessing they're a little more subtle.
Right. And many of the exotic pet species not only hide their disease, but also many of them are prey species, and so it's evolutionarily adaptive for them to not show a predator that they're sick. And so part of the whole process is watching for feeding behavior, watching in birds for vocalizations. One of the first things to disappear in a sick bird is their normal vocalizations, or a change in the quality of their vocalization. And many of the species, exotic pet species, have high metabolic rates. So if they go only for a few hours or a few days without food, then they're the crisis is imminent, and we need to deal with it right away.
Whereas a dog can go for a few days without food with no harm.
Exactly.
I think one of the big areas of healthcare, whether it's for people or for animals, is identifying and managing pain. How do you do that in these species that it must be a lot harder to figure out if they're in pain and what the cause is?
Yeah. So one of my areas of research is trying to understand pain in non-domestic species, including zoo and wildlife species. I've done a lot of work with reptiles and some with fish, but what's really difficult is first trying to understand, do they experience pain, for which I personally believe they do, and then what drugs might be best to manage and what dosages. How do we manage that pain? So in my experiences, especially with reptiles and fish, I've had to create develop ethograms, which is a method for which we look at normal behavior and try to determine what's normal in a ball python, for example, and what might be abnormal after a surgical procedure. And so trying to measure pain is really the sort of the key to understanding it. And then once we can measure it, we look at the different types of drugs that might be most effective. And a good example is, for years, reptile vets have given a certain drug for pain because it was what was used in mammals. So let's extrapolate. And that drug is called butorphanol. And through my research, we've found that butorphanol is no more effective than saline for pain management in reptiles. It's the drug of choice for birds, for example, but it just doesn't seem to work in the reptile species. But a different type of opioid drug, morphine, works very well in reptiles. So a lot of what's done in exotic pets is just extrapolated from dog and cat medicine and even human medicine. And so drug types, dosages, all of those sort of things are sort of taken from the dog and cat literature, and then we just hope for the best. And managing pain, I think, in my experience in reptiles and fish, you can get them to return to their normal behavior much more rapidly after a surgical procedure than no pain control, and we call them analgesics. A drug mm-hmm. for pain is an analgesic. So I'm finding that if I have to spay an iguana, for example, that iguana will behave more normally within 24 hours than if it's given an appropriate analgesic than an iguana that isn't given an analgesic. So
we're talking about the fascinating world of exotic pets with Dr. Kurt Slatke from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We'd love to have you join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll be back in a moment. Talking about exotic pet care with Dr. Kurt Slatke. And Christina posted a very sweet picture on the Facebook page. It says, Dulcie thanks you for this show. And it looks like Dulcie is a very cute little guinea pig.
Dulcie is at a close-up, face close-up of a very cute guinea pig. And guinea pigs are one of the species that we do worry about, especially getting getting heat stroke in the warmer weather. So.
Now, sometimes, like at the farmer's market, or maybe just, you know, outside in a park or something, I'll see someone with a ferret with them, or sometimes even a rabbit. And, you know, if you're out and about with your small mammal pet, what should you have with you? Should you make sure you have water or, you know, some kind of shelter for them?
Yeah, it's interesting to see ferrets and rabbits on leashes. A lot of people like to do that. I guess the worry is always that they get spooked. Like rabbits might get spooked easily and injure themselves on a harness. But it is important. Again, they have high metabolic rates, so their requirement for food and water is much higher than your average dog and cat. And so I think you need to emphasize, even maybe more importantly, to have water available for them.
Great.
And species like guinea pigs, they have this incredible requirement for water, a daily requirement for water, up to 100 mils per day. You know, that's just another one of these species differences mm-hmm. that, again, maybe speaks to the importance of learning as much as you can about the species that you're maintaining as your pet.
Great. Well, we have several people waiting to join the conversation, so let's go to the phones. And Dan in Mountain is first up. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Reflecting on iguanas, thank you, by the way. DDT that was sprayed in trees several years ago, even 20 years ago. Reflect on that. People like to put branches in their cage. I'll take my answer off air.
So basically the impact of herbicides or other kinds of pesticides.
Yeah, DDT is the pesticide that caused thinning eggshells and contributed to the bald eagle and peregrine falcon demise. And it's not been used in the U.S. for a few decades, but DDT is highly toxic and has caused problems in wildlife, and it sticks around in the environment for a very long time. So it is in the environment. Those animals exposed that are long-lived and exposed to DDT, the DDT tends to stay in the fat of the body and can leach over time. The problem DDT is really, there are very few good studies where there's a clear cause and effect of pesticide, herbicide, and disease. But we do believe there are many associations between exposure to pesticide, herbicides, and disease, or at least immune compromise. And if you're an animal exposed or a human exposed to some of these chemicals, I believe that there's some immune compromise, so it can be an insidious effect, and some animals that may succumb to a real disease may actually have a compromised immune system from being exposed to a variety of herbicide pesticides. We just don't fully understand it.
Well, and as you said, with those higher metabolisms, they're taking it in at a much faster rate, I'm guessing.
Right, and species like aquatic species in the wild, where these chemicals leach into the aquatic environment, many of the fish-eating birds were exposed to fish that had a lot of these chemicals mm-hmm. in their fat. So peregrine falcons and bald eagles are piscivores or fish eaters, and they tended to get exposed to a lot of the DDT through consumption of fish where the chemical sort of bioaccumulated mm-hmm. in the tissues of the fish.
It's similar to larger fish eating smaller fish and then having more mercury
exactly.
in their systems
too. Exactly.
Thanks for that call. And let's go to Jennifer in Minocqua next. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you. I have a question about, also I'm hard of hearing, so I can either talk or listen, one or the other.
Go ahead and talk.
Okay. I'm curious about the arachnid population and how you do the diagnostics on them, if there are any you can do.
And let's talk about what falls under arachnids first, Kurt.
So arachnids include basically spiders. So common pet arachnids would be scorpions as well, although I wouldn't encourage that because they're venomous. But tarantulas, also venomous, but tend to be more like a bee sting if they bite you. So spiders, scorpions tend to be arachnids. What an excellent question about diagnostics, because arachnids have hemolymph. They don't have blood. And they have a sort of an open body cavity. So they don't have like an abdomen and a chest. They do have thorax and abdomen, but they're all, the body fluids all flow through all of that together. So there's one big connecting space in an arachnid. The hemolymph that they have, we can actually draw samples through their exoskeleton with a small needle and syringe and run it much like a blood sample. And they have certain cell types in their hemolymph, and they have certain chemicals in their hemolymph that can that we can analyze and try to determine what organ system might tend to be affected. Obviously, arachnids are great at hiding disease, and a lot of times if they're kept in a small cage, they're not all that active, and so people have a difficult time judging when they're not moving as much or when they're not eating as much. Obviously, if you're feeding crickets to a tarantula, you can see that the crickets are not being consumed and are not being eaten over a certain course of time. But we also see invertebrates on invertebrates. We see mite infestations on arachnids where we have to actually sedate the animal and physically pull the mites off of the arachnid, because if we use a pesticide against the mite, the pesticide is going to kill the spider or the tarantula. So,
and those mites would be parasitic.
Exactly.
So it could really drain the
right,
and we both literally and figuratively drain the arachnid.
Right, and we can actually sedate it in a tarantula using a gas anesthetic that you or I might be exposed to during a surgical procedure, isoflurane, sevoflurane. We can actually put the tarantula, a little mask with the gas over the top, and they absorb it. They have mm-hmm. they have respiratory pores all over their body, and they actually absorb it and go down very quickly. Once we have them relaxed, then we can take our diagnostic samples.
Wow, so that's fascinating. Thanks for that question, Jennifer. And let's go to Daryl in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. My girlfriend has been talking about getting a pygmy marmoset, and I was just wondering if there's any drawbacks or anything to having a monkey.
It looks like Kurt's glad that you called. Kurt?
Yes. So I strongly recommend not purchasing primates as pets for a variety of reasons. One is you really don't. Many people buy these animals over the internet, and the animals are taken away from their mothers early so that they can adapt to being around people. Primates need to be with their mothers for a long time. Primates carry a lot of diseases, And I can guarantee with 100% certainty, and I would never say this about anything in exotic pet medicine, but I can guarantee with 100% certainty that when that animal goes through puberty, it's going to bite somebody. Eventually, a primate, no matter what species it is going to bite somebody. And now you're going to be held liable for an animal that's bitten somebody. And many states will actually ask veterinarians to euthanize an animal after it has bitten somebody because of the scare of rabies of being transmitted. So I would strongly recommend, even though primates are very cute and baby primates are become very, very dependent on you and baby-like, there are all kinds of problems with maintaining primates as pets.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Cyril. And it sounds like, I mean, there are a lot of good reasons, but it also feels like, I mean, primates were primates, right? I mean, there are very similar types of the types of diseases that a monkey could get could easily be transmitted in a lot of cases
exactly.
to human beings and vice versa, I'm guessing. I mean, that person could be bringing home a lot of diseases just from being out in the world that could affect that monkey too.
Right. So I do see pet primates. I'm not saying I don't. And we, I have a lot of primate experience, medical experience. So those people who have primates need somewhere to go for dealing with disease, dealing with husbandry issues. But absolutely, there are diseases that are transmitted between people and primates, vice versa, sort of back and forth. One of the big ones that we worry about is herpes B virus, which is a virus carried by macaque species. And once transmitted to people, it can be fatal if untreated or if you don't know. And you can be bitten, you can be exposed through a bite, you can be exposed through urine splashes in your eyes or fecal contamination. Disease transmission between species that are very close to us is going to happen commonly. Tuberculosis is another one. Tuberculosis, we can transmit to primates. They can transmit to us. Measles transmitted to something like a marmoset or a tamarin will be fatal. Measles transmitted from a zookeeper in the zoo to the gorilla will cause measles in the gorilla.
Wow.
So,
well, and they're also very social animals. So it seems like having a primate who's probably going to be by themselves a lot is not very fair to the animal either.
It isn't. And what happens is there are many unscrupulous primate breeders, and they will remove the baby from mom after just a couple days to make them more dependent on people. Well, all you've done is created an animal that develops all kinds of stereotypical behavior, whether it's sucking on its tail or rocking and huddling. You know, it's just like taking, any primate taken away from their mother too early would be, you know, would develop similar things that a human would develop if taken away from mother too early. So,
well, thanks for that call, Daryl, and I hope you can maybe persuade your girlfriend to go in a different direction. We're talking with Dr. Kurt Slatke, who specializes in exotic pet medicine at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And we do have time for some more calls and some lines open. So feel free to join the conversation. Do you have a pet that's considered an exotic? What kind is it? And what do you enjoy about it? Would you recommend it as a pet? Or maybe you're intrigued by the idea of an exotic pet, but you're not quite sure what kind might be a good fit for you and your family. Dr. Kurt Slatke would be happy to answer those questions at 1-800-642-1234. And just to let you know, coming up at 11:45, Dr. Carrie Donahue will be with us. She specializes in holistic pet care through Full Circle Veterinary Clinic, and she'll be here to talk about how to prevent and treat summer ailments with natural and alternative products. And Kurt, you know, we were talking about wild animals and wild animals that should stay wild animals. But right now at this time of year, a lot of people are going to be coming across wild animal babies. And often people don't know if they should interact with them or not. They don't know if the babies have been abandoned or not. What are kind of some good guidelines for that?
Yeah, this happens a lot this time of year. Baby rabbits are classic. Somebody disturbs a nest or with lawn mowing or something like that, disturbs a nest, and a baby might appear, baby rabbit might appear next to the nest out as if it's totally separated from its mother. Well, mother rabbits will come back and retrieve the baby, and so I would encourage people not to, if they see a baby rabbit just out and about, just leave it alone. Let the mom try to come and deal with it, because a lot of these babies will be reunited with their mother. The mother is just off feeding because they have a very high requirement for with a litter of baby rabbits, there's a high requirement for good nutrition to provide the milk that's being suckled constantly by the baby. So leave baby rabbits alone. Once you take them away from their mother and the nest, they're very difficult to actually keep alive. We have a lot of formulas that we can feed baby rabbits, and sometimes it's necessary by wildlife rehabbers to feed baby rabbits, but we certainly can't do as good a job as mom can do.
And we had a comment from Rebecca in Platteville earlier. We were talking about birds being quite delicate in a lot of ways, and she said she wanted to warn people about the danger that overheating Teflon pans can pose to birds. Hers died last summer after she made that mistake. What's that about, Kurt?
That's a classic toxicity problem in birds. It's sort of a textbook, something we teach our students about, but we don't see very much anymore. If you leave a pan on the stove, a Teflon-coated pan on the stove, and you forget about it, the Teflon fumes that come off of that pan become aerosolized, and if there's a bird anywhere near, they can die very quickly from, again, we're back to the canary in the coal mine, but they can die very quickly from inhaling those fumes. Those fumes aren't good for us either,
right.
But particularly small birds will be affected. That also goes for, honestly, birds kept near bathrooms where there's a lot of hairspray being used or perfumes. All of those things bird owners need to pay attention to. Birds are acutely sensitive to aerosolized fumes and toxins, and so it's important to keep your bird away from exposure to those sort of things.
Well, sorry about that, but thanks for sharing that. Let's go to Martha in Duluth, who has a good general question, I think. Martha, hi.
Yes, I wanted to know how you find a veterinarian to deal with exotic animals. Several years ago, we had a bird for many, many years, just a little budgie, and the bird got sick, and every veterinarian I called said that they don't do birds. And we ended up, the closest one we could find was 100 miles away, and it was just too difficult in the middle of winter to bring a sick bird to 100 miles to a vet.
Well, I think that's a great question because, you know, exotic pets, I think, are getting more and more popular. How do you find a vet that's appropriate to treat them?
Thank you, Martha. That's a great question, and one that I'm having to deal with quite a bit. There are very few trained veterinarians to handle exotic pets. Those vets who have gone through a formal residency program to treat either birds or reptiles, or in my case, my training and my colleagues' training at the vet school is in zoological medicine, which essentially covers every species. It's a very rigorous training. Many of our clients, and I encourage people to do a lot of research, and you can always contact somebody like us at the vet school to see if we can help you find a vet that may have some experience, at least may not be fully trained, but may have some experience with some of the exotic pet species. We have people coming from Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota fairly regularly to our clinic looking for specialists. In the state of Wisconsin, for example, there are no specialists at all, except for those of us at the vet school. There are some vets that do a good job with some of the species that exotic pet species, but in general, it's hard for me to make any recommendations, specific recommendations. We do get referrals from Minnesota and in Duluth. Some of the veterinarians up there may suggest that if it's something very critical that you come and see us. And we'd encourage you to even contact us if you need some advice.
All right. Thanks for that call, Martha. And let's wrap up with Ruth in Eagle. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Ruth.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I'm fine. My question was, I was curious about what is the most popular exotic animal that people buy, and also which would be the best and easiest to take care of if you wanted an exotic animal.
Great. Thanks, Ruth.
Thanks for the question. I would say most popular pets sort of changes over the years. Right now, we're seeing fewer birds than we did 10 years ago as pets, and we're seeing of the reptiles, are probably most popular reptiles right now are bearded dragons, ball pythons if you want a snake. Bearded dragons are relatively easy to maintain. Snakes are carnivorous, and you have to feed frozen mice, thawed frozen rodents of some sort, but they are easy to maintain because of that. Some of the herbivorous animals are much more difficult to maintain. And I would say of the mammals, most popular mammalian pets right now, rabbits are probably the number one. Other rodents, we still see a lot of guinea pigs and chinchillas and pet rats. See fewer ferrets than we once did.
They were really popular there for a while.
Ferrets were very popular. They develop almost universally. They'll develop some sort of cancer, a neoplastic disease of their adrenals or of their pancreas, and so they've become less popular over the years. In terms of bird pets that are relatively easy to maintain, people tend to get budgies, many people still refer to as parakeets, but they're really budgies, or cockatiels tend to be fairly easy. And if you're interested in getting an exotic pet, please do some reading and contact a vet who knows right away. Bring the animal to a vet right away so you can get some nutrition information and you can get an exam done. Those are really important immediately after purchasing an exotic pet.
Thanks for that call, Ruth, and that was a great place to end. And unfortunately, we're out of time. Kurt, always really interesting to learn about exotic pets and how to care for them. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you, Judith. Appreciate it.
Dr. Kurt Slatke is a clinical associate professor in zoological medicine and section head of the Special Species Health Service at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. It's always so interesting to hear about the wide variety of creatures that can really make great pets. Coming up next, we'll learn about the variety of natural treatments that can complement conventional medical treatments for our dogs and cats. Dr. Carrie Donahue combines traditional and alternative approaches for holistic pet healthcare, and she'll be with us in just a moment. So I hope you'll stay tuned right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.